Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
Hello, this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. Agoristradio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Hello, all you cypherpunks. Welcome back to the show. This is Hero White. Today we have a returning special guest with us from the Voucher Safe Project, which is some of you, if you haven't heard of the project or listened to our previous show, it's something to check out. It's a secure P2P digital cash system and infrastructure system. And it's not just software, but a complete solution for issuing assets, and assets are going online with this pretty soon. And back with us today is Justin. And Justin, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Hero. Thanks for having me back.
Good. There is a topic we were talking before the show that there was something you wanted to talk about that had to do with certain things that this project was looking to address and some issues and problems that you've come up with it. You want to just go ahead and tell us what that's about?
Sure. I mean, I think what we need to do is, when we're designing a next generation payment system, is think about the past and think about the kinds of things that have happened before and what's happened to and with previous generation payment systems. And I know everybody thinks of eGold as an example of what happened to a previous payment system, mm-hmm. and likewise Liberty Dollar. But these things were actually not the first of their kind. I mean, Doug Jackson and Bernard von Nonhaus were not the first of their kind. There was a group in the 1980s that was in a western state in the U.S., Colorado, I think it was. And it was called the National Commodity and Barter Association, the NCBA.
Uh-huh.
And what have you ever heard of them?
No. This is great.
All right. Well, this was back in the era BI, that is before internet.
Uh-huh.
And they did what the National Commodity and Barter Association did, as its name suggests, is that they had a warehouse where people would bring their gold coin and bullion, and they would issue warehouse receipts against the deposited coins.
Mm-hmm.
And this then functioned as barter script, which they would then use. Of course, they were doing it, you know, the membership would trade the barter script to pay each other for goods and services, and they weren't doing it with computers. I mean, this was all before they got to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And however, they met with essentially the same response that eGold got, which is that federal agencies, particularly the IRS, was all over these people. They were all over these people like a white tiger on an effeminate German magician. They infiltrated them. They put a receptionist in their office who was an undercover agent. They did all sorts of things to them. And I think the reason is probably because this group mainly served the Patriot community. And for those who may not know, Patriot community was what they used to call the Tea Party 20, 30 years ago. And so there were a lot of anti-government people, and they were also very much like NORFED. They were an abolish the Fed, get rid of the IRS, you know, type of a political slant to their organization.
Yeah, and this would, and so, if I could interject in here, this would have been back around the time of Waco and when things were really flaming up around that time.
Well, Waco was actually a little bit later, but
oh, okay.
Probably maybe more about the all the whole the Waco, Ruby Ridge, Oklahoma City, all those kind of things happened in the early to mid 90s, and this was probably about a decade earlier.
Oh, okay.
But nevertheless, they were an anti-New World Order educational organization,
yeah, sure.
And they also had this barter thing going on. And so the IRS tried to say that the whole thing was illegal and barter, was illegal and so on. And they went to court. And in those days, I guess it was easier to find a federal judge who would be appalled by what the government they worked for was actually doing. And this judge threw the case out and said, "You leave those people alone." And it, I gather in pretty much that tone of voice. And ordered the return of the gold. There was about $2 million worth of gold, which is probably
wow.
a fair amount at the prices that they had back then.
Uh-huh.
And ordered the return of the seized gold and so on, and sternly lectured the IRS that these people weren't doing anything wrong, they weren't breaking any laws, and what are you doing hounding them? And instead of taking their rebuff and, staring at their shoes and shuffling their toes and saying, "Yes, sir, sorry, sir," instead they basically thumbed their noses at the judge. They whipped up a bunch of new charges. They said it was an illegal tax shelter. That was their next thing.
Okay.
And so they re-seized the gold on that pretext, without even bothering to return it first in the interim, of course. And more stuff happened. And so the fellow who was running it, a guy named John Voss, not to be confused with John Ross, the author of Unintended Consequences, but okay. V-O-S-S was his name. And
okay.
This gentleman received a subpoena for all the records that the organization had, their membership records, their, bailment records, everything. And he didn't go through with it. I mean, he refused to turn over the data, despite a court order to do so, and he did 2 years in Club Fed for contempt of court.
Really?
Yeah, really. Yeah. But he did manage, by his action, to stop the investigation, because you know how this kind of thing works. I mean, once they have the files, they start going through the files. It's the IRS. They're going to tax audit with a fine-tooth comb everybody on that list. And pretty soon, they're going to get somebody who's in violation, and they're going to say, "We got you, but here's your way out. You got to testify against the people who run this NCBA thing."
Right.
And this is how this kind of thing works, and these are the tactics that are used. And so by not giving the data, Mr. Voss actually stopped the investigation cold. He was the only person who went to jail. I actually met this fellow at one point some years later, about maybe 5 or 10 years later. And this fellow was an unsung American hero, because he clearly perceived that you just can't give them any data. And so that was what they did. And so fast forward a little bit to something a little more modern. Doug Jackson doesn't really have John Voss's choice, because, the goons come to the door with the guns and the warrant, and they say, "We're seizing your computers and we're going to image all your disks."
Mm-hmm.
And he can't stop it. And he doesn't have the choice to not disclose, because by this time all the records, they're not in a card file or something. They're actually, they're here. And so the government gets all the data. And from that point, things go downhill. So the problem that you have in each of these kinds of cases, and I think we've seen that same issue to some extent, even with Liberty Dollar, because, of course, they had records of all the silver they'd ever minted or sold to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't like they could claim, "Oh, no, we didn't do that." Of course they did, and there were voluminous records to prove it. And so the question is, if you're going to make a payment system, one of the very first things you have to do is you have to make it impossible for the operators of the system to be subpoenaed and to divulge any kind of meaningful data. I mean, what if the data were encrypted in such a manner that it was physically impossible for them to turn over customer data? I mean,
mm-hmm.
Egold used to get subpoenas all the time. Give us all the records about this and such account. Tell us everyone they've paid and everybody who's paid them and all their account history and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have to fulfill those orders. I mean, that was back in the day before they just started imaging the whole database.
Yeah, right.
I mean, but it, you know, they would do the normal state of affairs where there's some kind of investigation, and they say, well, you have a customer account with this number, and we want all the records from it. Well, what if it was impossible? Not because you were stonewalling, and not because, you know, you're sort of contumaciously saying, I'm not going to give you the data.
But
simply because it's impossible. Well, there is, believe it or not, even in the U.S., there is a still a legal principle that says that law may not compel the impossible. And it's, people do actually get off on that that basis. For example, there, I'll tell you another very brief amusing story, and that was, there was a company in Florida, that, I think it was Florida, that, that did moonshots for, or not moonshots, but orbit shots for ashes. It was burial in space.
Mm-hmm.
And there were certain people like the actor Jimmy Doohan, who played Scotty on Star Trek.
Yeah.
When he died, he, some portion of his ashes were shot into space along with other people's. And it was, I don't know, maybe people are still in this, but anyway... there was a law in Florida that said that you had to have a two-lane paved road to the place of interment if you were engaging in this sort of business. And, of course, this company didn't have one. I mean, duh, how are you going to make a paved two-lane road to orbit, you know? And so the state of Florida actually prosecuted them for failure to have this road. And I mean, I'm not making this up. I mean, this is too weird to actually make up. And the good news for them is that the judge ruled that the state of Florida was certifiably insane and threw the case out because it is impossible for even the law to compel the impossible. And so this was one of the problems as we're looking at the history of payment systems and alternative currencies. One of the big problems you have is that if you have any kind of success, if anybody's actually using your system, at some point you're going to attract negative attention, and you have to say, well, what's our strategy for dealing with this? And so when I first saw the VoucherSafe architecture, which was probably about, you know, 3 years ago when we started emailing back and forth about it, and that was the thing that really leaped out at me. It was that, you know, the way this system is architected, it's not possible for anybody who's operating one of these nodes to give any meaningful data, even if they could be identified and subpoenaed and so on.
Yeah, it's sort of a
zero-knowledge system. Yes, the data is actually protected from the operators at the same time that it's protected from a user, you know, perspective or a rogue user. And so even if somebody puts thumbscrews on one of the people that's operating one of these servers, it's not going to do any good. And that was the thing that really leaped out at me and sold me on the architecture. And I came into it when we were ready to do the architecture was fairly well settled. But we wanted to do the implementation. And that brings me to the second thing I wanted to talk about, which is a problem that we're really not trying to solve.
Okay.
And that is the problem of better money. That was Eagold's slogan. I mean, you saw it every time you went to their website. It's Eagold is better money. And I heard a presentation by James Turk, the founder of Gold Money, about probably 1997 or so, shortly after they came online. And James Turk talked about how gold was better money. It's not counterfeitable. It's been used for thousands of years. And this new gold money system was just going to take over the world and usurp all commerce. And everything was just going to use, you know, gold that you could collect with a mouse instead of all those cumbersome wire transfer systems and all that other kind of nonsense in the banking system. And I really get sort of James Turk flashbacks and echoes in my head every time I hear listen to one of these Bitcoiners, because it's all the same ideas about, you know, we're revolutionizing the nature of money itself. And incidentally, I just yesterday listened to the show you had with Mike Gogolsky, who was talking about his Bitcoin mining and so on, and he made the comment that there was $40 million worth of circulating Bitcoin, and that was the biggest an alternative currency had never been or had ever been. And Eagold was about twice that size back in its heyday. But the big elephant in the room is gold money, which is something like $1.5 billion worth of metal that's in the system. However, the thing to recognize about gold money is that it doesn't circulate. Most of those people who have accounts, I'll bet the only payment that they make, the only transaction they ever log, is when they buy and sell gold. Most of the gold is not circulating. The very same thing is true about pecunix, which is much smaller than gold money, but again, most of the money sits there as a gold savings account, and it doesn't circulate. And the reason for that is not because these people don't agree with Jim Turk that gold is better money, or with Doug Jackson, who said the same thing, but because they do agree with them. Mm-hmm. And it comes down to, why would I spend my gold if some guy that I'm trying to pay will actually accept fiat trash? If he'll take my credit card, why would I send him gold? And that's what happens, is that the people that see the value of the money are those who are attracted to obtain money in that system, but then they're more incented to hoard it. I mean, after the novelty has worn off about the coolness factor of paying for, you know, your new laptop with gold or something, okay? But after you've done that, you're going to hold on to your gold and hoard it, because it's related to Gresham's law, which said that, you know, bad money drives out good. And I will make a prediction about Bitcoin. If it is as good as its proponents think it is, the very same thing will happen. That what you'll end up with is an economy that will get to a certain size, and then it will stop being spent. Because when people have a choice, and if a vendor you're dealing with will take either Bitcoin or your credit card and, you know, fiat currency in a bank somewhere, you're going to want to spend the latter, because you're going to see the former as being more valuable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a question. In the gold money system, what kind of money movement options are there? To send a wire transfer of cash and to get gold in your account, and then to pull that out via wire transfer?
Yes, you can buy and sell, but you can also, you have to have a verified account to do a customer verified account to do anything.
Okay.
But once you're verified, you do have the ability, just as you did at eGold, to spend money to another verified account.
Okay.
And so users can spend to each other a lot. I'm not saying that, you know, $1.5 billion is insignificant uptake. It's enormous uptake. I mean, that's a huge market. I mean, you know, it's fantastic what they've been able to do. But in terms of replacing the global monetary system with a monetary system based on gold, it hasn't even, you know, scratched the surface of doing that. And so that's one of the problems that we're not trying to solve with VoucherSafe. When we first started, I mean, you noted in our last talk that pecunix is listed as a potential issuer there. And we were definitely thinking that all the test stuff is all in grams of gold, and everything was, you know, it's definitely going to be a next generation gold payment system. But we came to realize, as we were going through this and over the past couple of years, that changing the nature of money is a problem which is outside the scope of the project. Do we need a better monetary system that doesn't fuel, you know, all these rapacious regimes of plunder and war and genocide? Of course we do. But that's outside the scope of the project. And I think a lot of those changes will just sort of come naturally as things evolve in the world anyway. But it's not for us to determine what it is that is money, or what it is that people, quote unquote, should be using as money. Uh-huh. As our job is to provide a better payment system, not better money.
Right.
And so that is why we're looking at two issuers. One will be in U.S. dollars and one will be in euros. That will be the first two issuers that will come out of the gate here. And one might ask, and you know, this is a long preface to answer a sort of implied question, which is that why would one go ahead and you know, go through all this trouble and labor and so on, and what you're really making is sort of like more like a better PayPal than it is a better eGold?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a payment. Yeah. There's you said at the you're not looking to replace, you're not looking to create better money. And you're not necessarily looking to replace an entire financial system or infrastructure, but you're looking at creating a way of a payment, a value transfer payment system. So
that is the most
important. For me, I think that is one of the most important things in all of these things that are going on. I really agree with the point that you have, that you're making with this. And this is the value that I see in Bitcoin. It's not a storage of value. The only value that I see in Bitcoin is the same. It's basically very much aligned with the statement that I said in the last show, that a fellow traveler, as a quote from fellow traveler, which said that he feels that the value that eventually comes out of Bitcoin is going to be the value that people that is derived out of its usability for people to as a means of transfer of value back and forth, not as a means of store. And that is what I see is the most important thing, is how can I take money that I have or receive money from other people, and I really don't care what it is. That's why I'm crazy for Loom also. Loom is not a gold-backed system. There may be some gold-backed currency in it, but there's all kinds of assets in there, and I'm completely cool with anything and everything as money, as long as people have the ability to, through free association, to agree and to exchange value back and forth with each other. So this is great. I like the...
Right. Well, and that's has become our philosophy. And we sort of started out saying, let's have a next generation gold payment system that will be truly anonymous digital cash. And our goal sort of morphed as we went along. And so, you know, we really have to focus on the payment system and not worry about the details of what is money.
Yeah.
And, you know, after hearing your talk with Mike, I think it was Friday,
yeah.
after listening to that, I think I made a statement in the previous show that I couldn't imagine why, since Bitcoins are already a digital instrument, why anybody would want to create vouchers that represented Bitcoins. But after listening to Mike talk and listening to and thinking about the things he said about doing you know, sort of mixed master anonymous remailer Ripple type things with Bitcoins, I got to thinking that maybe that I spoke too soon. Because what if you had a big store, an issuer that had a big store of Bitcoins, and you issued vouchers against those Bitcoins? You could circulate those vouchers through N generations, you know, splitting them up any number of different ways, scattering them among any number of people.
Yeah.
And you would never need to actually transact a Bitcoin until the moment when somebody wanted to cash in or out.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I say, I want to redeem my vouchers for my Bitcoins, by golly. And at that point, you'd have to have a Bitcoin spend that goes into the traceable, because, you know, as you pointed out, all the Bitcoin spends are traceable, at least with the anonymous handles that are being used. And so maybe I was wrong. Maybe you actually would want to have an issuer that, you know, basically sat there as a cache of Bitcoins, and you basically circulated the value of the Bitcoins via vouchers without actually touching the Bitcoins.
Yeah,
and
you know,
this
is the fire. This right here is the fire, the nitro right now that is under Fellow Traveler's development effort right now. I mean, the stuff that he's doing right now is focused primarily on this merging of the digital cash value transfer systems and the Bitcoin, as seeing Bitcoin just as this mechanism, as sort of like a backing thing that has its own properties, but then using all this other digital cash stuff that Bitcoin doesn't bring to the table at all, and merging them together. This is what his big thing is. And he's in his interface, he's working on integrating this with the, well, I don't know how much development's been done on it, but he's developing the framework to allow it for the integration of the voucher safe stuff also with the stuff he's doing with the Bitcoin and the other accounts and systems that he has to have, you know, integrate them together. Yeah, man, this is, yeah.
Well, so anyway, you said before that, when we were talking before the show, you said you had some specific questions you wanted to go into about the different nodes in the architecture, and this may be a little hard for listeners who don't have the sort of org chart in front of them, but would you like to move ahead with some questions about that, or?
Yeah, let's see. There's we were talking with Nefario. He's behind the main guy behind the Bitcoin Global Stock Exchange, which is turning into this big market board and what do you call it, the board of trade type of a thing. And his interface, I'm not sure if you listened to the show. If not, I recommend it for everybody. On that, we talked about the possibilities for integrating other currencies into the system, so that right now he's just accepting in exchange or a deposit or whatever you want to call it into the stock exchange system of Bitcoins. And once it's in there, then you have this big market of all these assets done with Ricardian contracts. A lot of it's influenced with the open transactions stuff. And the interface, the API for actually putting money into the system, our assets into the system to trade and pulling them out, is very much like it is with Loom, and it would be almost exactly the same for the voucher safe system also. So we talked about the ability of being able to have these other currencies in the system. So he's he said, yeah, that's planned for, and he loves the idea, and he's completely hip for it because he's hot for all the stuff that we're talking about, not just locking down to the Bitcoin. So yesterday he was in the Agora IRC channel on agora.anarpux.net, and he was talking about how they're looking at moving the interface into, and we had discussed this in the previous show, moving over to an XMPP architecture, so you don't have just this client server, your client, and then communicating through HTTP requests to a typical traditional web server, but actually doing an architecture of XMPP. So I told him that we were going to have you on the show soon, and that we were going to try to focus on some of that, because there's several issues I'll lay out here that I have right off the top of my head, and then you can throw
okay.
in all kinds of things that you've encountered. Okay. One, when you're developing this, there's two types of XMPP. Oh, by the way, if for listeners that are out there, XMPP, most people know it as Jabber. Google Talk runs on it. Lots of Pidgin, Audium, lots of chat programs out there support this chat system back and forth. So I guess even Google Talk, the chat and the voice over IP is doing XMPP stuff. But anyway, originally it was just for chat messaging, but it's actually a complete protocol for an infrastructure or P2P or a client server, however you want to set it up, just for people communicating back and forth. And you can do this it's also a federated server system. So you have maybe 1,000 different XMPP, I'll just call them Jabber XMPP. You have 1,000 XMPP servers out there that you connect to the server with your client, and then you are seen by other people. And then when they send messages to you or you send messages out to them, you never communicate. Well, in a typical setup, you don't communicate directly with them. You connect to your local server or server that you're connected with, and if they're on that server, they get the message. If they're on another server, then that server relays so to the other server that they're on. That server then connects to their client. So it's this big federated message distribution system, and it's all based on XML formatted packets. So that's the introduction for people who are not too familiar with it. So the VoucherSafe system uses this type of a thing. So one, when you're setting up a system like this, there's two types of clients basically that you can have. You can have yourself as a regular client, or you can have yourself as an XMPP module that's running on one of these federated servers. And I want to find out why would you not want to just go as a client all the time, and what does a module actually give you over just running as a particular client? I guess we'll just start with that.
Okay, well, I mean, I guess the short answer is both, because all of the servers, I mean, there are five servers, and just for those who aren't familiar with the architecture of the VoucherSafe system, there are five XMPP servers with which your client talks, where your client talks to all but one of them, and the servers talk amongst themselves. And they are what's called the OFS, which is stands for the Open Fire Server. It's not very imaginatively named, because it just the server actually happens to be an OpenFire instance, which is a published source Jabber server done by Jive Software. And that is your gateway. And then you also have a PKS, which is a public key server. And all that is it just simply stores voucher safe public keys, which are signed by the voucher publisher. And certificates. It stores the certificates on a key ring, and it serves them up when it's requested to do so, when one of the other nodes or another client says, give me the public key for this guy's voucher safe, and gives the voucher safe number. It simply returns, okay, here's the key. And then there is what's called an SDS, or a secure data store. And what this stores data, and it's just an XMPP front end to a database is all it is. And all of the data that's stored there is always encrypted with keys that are not on the SDS. Right. And then you have what's called a DHT, and it stands for distributed hash table, but that's a little bit of a misnomer because it, at present it really isn't distributed. It's just like the SDS, except that it stores data temporarily. Think of it as scratch space. It's where notifications to other clients who might not even be logged in at the present time are stored, indicating you have an incoming voucher safe or incoming voucher payment, or I picked up your voucher payment and here is your receipt that I've generated and signed for you. So it's just a place for servers and clients to exchange data in sort of an offline way. And then, of course, the last one is the voucher publisher itself. And the voucher publisher is sort of the coordinator of the whole thing. It takes the messages that are routed to it from the OFS. And I should point out that no one ever talks to a VP, to a voucher publisher, directly. Or no client ever does. It always goes through the OFS. So even if your client doesn't support a proxy, or even if an XMPP does, just like HTTP, supports proxies, so you can actually connect to a server indirectly through a proxy. But the OFS is always your proxy to the VP. And part of that is to protect the VP and to keep the VP from knowing any IP addresses of any of the clients, and keep, you know, and be able to keep the VP you know, behind a firewall, as it were. And so those are the five components. Now, those five components are all implemented as server plugins. They are all written as OpenFire plugins. One of the things that attracted us to OpenFire is that it has a plugin architecture at the server level. And so one of the things that GET gives you is the ability to register what are called IQ packet extensions. And what a packet extension is, or first of all, what an IQ packet is it's a type of message. There are three basic types of XMPP messages. There are messages in the sense of a unidirectional message, like I type hello, how are ya, and it goes over and displays on your screen. And then there are presence messages, which basically are the ones that let you know when your buddies in your list are logged in or not. And then there are what are called IQ packets, which are info query packets. And they basically have two forms. It's either a GET or a SET. The GET's for read-only, and the SET is for a read-write transaction. And then they return either a result or an error. And IQ packets, and in fact all of the packets, but IQ packets in particular, are extensible. That is, they have a child element in the XML that is user-definable. And so what we do is we create a set of messaging that goes between any of the two points, like between the client and the OFS, or between the OFS and the VP, or between the VP and the SDS, or what have you. And you define an XML namespace for that, and then you basically just register a packet extension handler so that whenever a message is received by the server that is in this namespace, it just routes it to your plugin.
Okay.
And that's actually quite nifty. Because it allows you to compartmentalize. You don't have to rewrite the entire server, but you can absolutely isolate everything you're doing that's specific to your types of messages and your particular messages just by looking at their opcodes and looking at what, you know, making sure they're well-formed and so on. And this actually has another benefit for security, because if a server receives a message that is not part of that namespace, it just simply filters it out and rejects it. I mean, it rejects the packet because it says, I don't know about that namespace. And this is one of the ways that, for example, suppose you had a voucher client and you connected it up to a Jabber server that didn't have the right plugins and didn't speak voucher safe. And those messages would be rejected or be dropped, or depending on, you know, how the server was programmed or how it was configured, it basically wouldn't get you anywhere. You couldn't log in. You couldn't do anything. And all of the logins that we do with the Java web app client that we have, all of those are done anonymously. And this is one of the reasons why it doesn't also permit ordinary chat, so that, you know, it isn't like Pigeon or something where you just bring up a chat and you start talking to somebody. Because how would you know who they were? I mean, everybody's logged in as an anonymous 8-digit, you know, hexadecimal number, and you know, how would you know? And it's going to change every time that person logs in. So how would you even know who you're talking to?
Okay, just let me try to interject a little bit every once in a while here.
Okay,
just to clarify some stuff. So you're saying when you connect to the server, you're generating like a random account basically every time you are connecting?
That's correct. There's two ways you can log into a Jabber server. And one is that you have created on that server a login handle, like Hero or whatever, okay? And it's at that domain. And that's called your JID, your JID, uh-huh. Your Jabber identifier. And the other way is to log in anonymously. And anonymous logins don't require anything to be done at the server. Oh. And as a matter of fact, we consider that, you know, while somebody could, the OFS, that gateway, is the only one that actually allows ordinary chats take place on it. So if somebody were connecting up with a plugin, and I should point out that the makers of OpenFire also have a Jabber client called Spark. Right. And Spark, likewise, has a plugin architecture, and we've written a voucher-safe plugin for Spark. So if you wanted to actually have a plugin in a regular voucher or regular Jabber client that gives that client the ability to speak to a voucher-safe network, you can do that. However, we figure that's probably not what most people are going to want to do. There's no reason why someone couldn't write. I mean, I understand Pigeon as a plugin architecture, too. I imagine somebody could write a voucher-safe plugin for Pigeon. Maybe I'll do that someday. But at any rate, so the answer to your question is both, because the user runs a client. And the way that it works is that the user logs in via the OFS. When they start their web app or when they start their client, it gets pointed in the JNLP file. It actually gets pointed at where the OFS of the gateway is, and it connects up to that Jabber server with an anonymous connection. And at that point, it prompts you for the voucher safe number and the PIN number. The OFS never sees either of those things. Instead, those things are hashed together in a SHA-512 hash and sent to the OFS, which then looks up the hash, that is, on the SDS. And if it's found, if you have a match, meaning you got it right, then it retrieves what's called your long phrase blob, and it never transmits that. Instead, it just looks at the length of it and asks you for three characters in it, and you pick those on a drop-down list that's shown in your client, all right? And if you guess those right and return the three characters back, then what the OFS does is it then retrieves a different record off the SDS and hands that back to the client, and that is your login blob, and that actually contains all the hashes at which your safe's data is stored at the SDS, because not only is the data encrypted, but there's no way to run a SQL command on the SDS that says select all vouchers that belong to the safe. It's select all vouchers that belong to this hash, and that's like, you know, 128-bit hexadecimal number. You know, I mean, good luck guessing one. And so the reason why the login is done this way is so that you don't have to trust the SDS, because that login blob is encrypted with your passphrase, and that's the last thing you have to enter when you're logging in, is your passphrase. And the reason it's this complex, you have a safe number, you have a PIN number, you have a long phrase, and you have a passphrase. And the reason all of those are necessary is to make the login procedure work in such a way that you don't have to trust any of the parties that you're talking to. You don't have to trust the OFS with your data. If the OFS were compromised, it wouldn't matter, because it never sees anything except hashes and encrypted data.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. Can I ask a question on a message that is being sent from your client to the server, the OpenFire server, with one of these modules running? Is this just is this a message that is addressed to a particular Jabber ID, or is it just a message in a particular format that's thrown at the server?
The latter. There's no things that are addressed. Well, actually, it's addressed to a server which is installed as a component. In other words, from the point of view of the OFS, it has a component in it, and this is part of the Jabber XMPP protocol as well, the idea of components. A component address, it would be like if your OFS was OFS.XMPP foo.com, then your voucher publisher might be vp.foo.com. And that would be, or vp.ofs.foo.com. It would be the name of the component. And so it routes to the component, and then the OFS goes, oh, that's for the voucher publisher. And it sends that down a server-to-server connection. And the server-to-server connections are also generated if you had a user that it was targeted at. As you pointed out when you were giving your little explanation there, if the other user you're chatting with is not on the same server, then the servers open up a connection between. This is the federated thing you were talking about. But there is no user that you're talking to. What you're talking to is the actual server. And as a matter of fact, after you've logged in, one of the things that the client does is it does network disco, and that doesn't mean that all the machines get out and boogie down under a stroboscopic lighting on a dance floor. It means what it's shorthand for network discovery, and it means that your client asks the OFS, okay, I've just logged into this voucher publisher's network, and the at vouchersafe.org domain or whatever it is. And can you please tell me where the SDS lives, where the DHT lives, and where the PKS lives? Because those are the three things I have to talk to in order to access my safe and communicate, make payments to other safes and so on. And so that's the first thing it does, is it queries, it discovers the network, and tells the client where those other servers are. And your client will then, on an as-needed basis, make anonymous logins to those servers. So your client actually has logins to four different Jabber servers that's sort of doing behind your back. Okay. And this is actually kind of handy, because if we ever wanted to move any of those servers, first of all, they're all running, except for the OFS gateway, they're all running as VMware vServers, vHosts, on boxes in various places in the world. And if we ever needed to move one, you just rsync the file over to another host. Maybe change some IP addressing in your host files or whatever, and then you're good to go. Because the entire thing, you don't have to ship any servers through FedEx or anything like that. You just rsync a file.
Right. So on this plugin that you would, if you did the plugin on the Spark client, okay, that plugin, when it logs in, it's logging in as one of these anonymous users, just like the other system. It's not
for the SDS, the PKS, and the DHT, yes. But for the main connection that it has to the OFS, which in this role is actually doubling as an ordinary Jabber server you can chat with, you would actually need a login. Okay. On the server for that.
But
that also gives you the ability to chat.
Right. Well, this is where I'm going with a bunch of these questions, is then you could not get an account at jabber.raceservers.com or jabber.org and log in with that with your Spark client and then have the voucher safe plugin running and then do stuff with that account. You actually need to be connected directly to one of these.
Right. You have to connect to an actual OFS gateway. And there can any voucher publisher can have N of those that are supported. And so you could do them in a round robin type of way if there was more than one. And likewise, any OFS can support one or more voucher publishers. And so this is the idea of this is that you end up with is the system grows, you end up with a federated network of different servers that are essentially franchised, and all of the nodes except for the PKS does not get paid for its efforts. It is the house elf of the VP, and all the rest of them, however, earn tokens as they perform operations. And so each of these servers is potentially a revenue generator.
Right. Let me ask you something on that. On any of these systems that you have a potential revenue generation in it, or is there economic incentive to run them, are there any possibilities that you can run those on what is called a low-trust server? Because a lot of talk has been going on with this. Fellow Traveler just announced some stuff publicly on this, and the idea is, many times you can have an economic incentive to run a particular type of service, but users have to trust you. And in the low trust server type of a situation is where you could actually run a server on public hardware on a shared server with lots of other people on the same VPS, running other VPSs, and you don't care who sees what or who gets copy of the data, but you are able to run it and still get economic and make some money from it. Is there any possibility of that?
Yes. The answer is yes. The only exception to that would be the voucher publisher itself.
Okay. Give me an example of one low-trust server that could be public.
Okay. Well, the OFS gateway can be a very low-trust server. Again, when everyone's logging in, it never sees a voucher safe number. It has no idea who's logging in. All it ever sees are as hashes and encrypted data blocks.
Okay.
All right. And every message that actually goes to the voucher publisher that is forwarded through it in its role as a router, as a gateway, is encrypted. Where there's what we call a voucher request object. And basically it would say, if you're making a payment, I'm offering the following vouchers as to pay. It's, and then I have the amount and the payee voucher safe that I want it to go to. And then any implied overage would be my change that I would get back if my input vouchers exceeded my output.
Okay. Who would somebody
and that gets encrypted using the key, the public key of the voucher publisher. And then it is sent to the OFS. So the OFS, not having that the voucher publisher's key, not having its private key, couldn't read it anyway. And so everything that the OFS hands back and forth is always opaque to the OFS. So could that be running on a low-trust server? Absolutely. It absolutely could. The only possible data you'd have there would be any data, local data, storing user login handles, Jabber IDs that were created on that server.
What risk would that be? That those are the chat IDs for people that were trying to...
Right, the chat IDs. And remember, if you're using the VoucherSafe web app client, those are all meaningless because they're all anonymous anyway.
Okay. Now, so this is the server you just talked, the low-trust possible server that can be run low-trust. What module was this that you just said? The OFS
gateway? Well, that's the OFS gateway. Okay. Yeah. That's probably the lowest-trust server.
Okay. And then is there anyone that is... that can be any other part of the system that can be run equally as low trust?
Yeah, I would say that the DHT certainly could be, because all it ever does is store messages that never last more than a week, after which they get purged. Those are always encrypted using the public key of the voucher safe that they're addressed to, whether it's a payment notification or a receipt. And you know, so all it does is it's a front end to a simple database that stores encrypted data that it has no ability to read.
Okay.
But the worst thing that could happen, I mean, is that if someone were destructively deleting things, people could miss their notifications and so on. I mean, that's not necessarily fatal to the system, but it opens up the possibility of malicious damage to interfere with the system's operation.
Right. Okay.
So you wouldn't want that, obviously.
Right.
The SDS is a little more sensitive because you wouldn't want, although all the data is encrypted and stored by hashes that aren't identifiable and so on, you wouldn't want somebody running, you know, delete star from a table on the device, you know, because that would be it would destroy people's data, you know.
Well, that leads to the next question then, is how many OpenFire OFS gateways, let's start with that, how many OFS gateways can a system have?
As many as needed. As I said, any voucher publisher can have N of these.
So let's just say that we have listeners out there right now that have machines scattered around the world, and they're interested in going ahead and throwing 15 or 20 of their machines as front-end gateways. Could they just contact you and say, hey?
I would, yes, I suppose, but you know what? There, at this point, since we're just starting out, there wouldn't be enough token revenue to go around.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it would be you have a sort of the traffic as it grows will justify that expansion.
Okay.
And that's the plan. I mean, when you put an economic model into the thing, that doesn't mean that you really want a dozen people to say, hey, I can run an OpenFire on thing on my server. That's easy. And yes, it is easy. And installing the plugin is a piece of cake. You just drop it in the plugins directory and it installs itself. And you do have to actually put a few things in the XML startup config files and in the database, and there's a console that lets you do that and so on. But you do have to configure a few things. But you could do it in 10 minutes if you knew what you were doing. And so, yeah, it's very, very simple to do that. And then you just put that server into the list in the JNLP file of the list of valid gateways that are supported, and you know, you're off and running. And so, you know, yeah, that's something that could be done. But at this point, the traffic isn't going to justify that. So that's where, you know, the franchise expands as it needs to, is where we'll take that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's great to know that you do actually have some elements that are low trust, because it just really opens up possibilities for optional locations and hardware that would normally not be able to even be considered because of, you know, just the problems of a low-trust server.
Well, you know, we had some thoughts about that the lowest trust thing is the gateway, which is also a chat server. But, you know, one of the few things that is actually still has meaningful legal protection in even in statist countries like the United States is the notion of free speech. And if you were trying to shut down a server that was also a chat server, or as the case of where the actual OFS is, also hosted several forum sites, an author's website, a couple of other, you know, community sites, there's a bunch of web hosts that are on this very same box. So, I mean, this is exactly the model of the low trust thing. You know, other things are running on it. It's not dedicated.
Oh yeah, that's really great. That's really great, because you try to shut down you're not trying to shut down. If you go after a system that is using one of these chat systems, you're shutting down a chat system. You're trying to shut down a chat system.
Of course.
You know, that's
you are stifling free speech. You are doing, you know, at this point, you let the lawyers in the Armani suits from New York go to work, because this is the stuff that gets up their nose.
Yeah.
And it went when somebody does this. And so all of the fact, you know, this is one of the things that drew me to building the system on top of XMPP in the first place, because it's a communications protocol. It's about individuals chatting peer-to-peer through a server. And good grief, if you wanted to go shut that down, I mean, the gateway is the obvious thing to try and shut down so people can't go to it, can't get there, can't connect to it. And how are you going to do that?
Yeah,
when you've got all these sort of human shields out there who are all talking to each other and claiming, you know, free speech, you know.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a good idea anyway, and I still think that.
Great. Well, that's really nice. I like that a lot. I know that on some of these sites that are actually doing, it's sort of related, some of the sites that are running Tor gateways, they actually have a standard boilerplate template that you can throw up on port 80, so that when people see that certain traffic is coming from this IP address, instead of just they call the police up and the police want to go out there and seize the server because something happened from this IP, but if they actually load up their browser and type in this IP, they'll see that it actually shows this is a Tor exit node. So, you know, it's sort of it's the same type of a thing where you're publicly letting everyone know that, you know, if you're going after this, you're going after a system that is helping people in oppressive.
Well, and it also establishes, you know, the plausible deniability. It's like, well, those packets may have come from here, but it ain't us, Buster.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's.
Well, let's see what we're doing here on the time here. Oh yeah, 53. We're coming up on the hour here. There's been some pretty decent information in here for people that are looking to develop applications and networking and using your tying in with your API to your system using the XMPP. One thing I wanted to talk about real quick, at least, is over XMPP, it's not a request response type system in and of itself. It's more like you send out a packet of information, and a lot of people a lot of people in web development and programming right now, they're more used to this HTTP or XML RPC, this RPC type thing where you throw something out, the socket is open, and then a response comes back. So you have a request, and you have a response. You request a response. And in the XMPP system, you're just throwing stuff out there. So how, and I've only seen one library out there for XMPP RPC, and I'm pretty sure it's only written in JavaScript, and I haven't looked into it too much detail. But all the other stuff is just either JSON RPC, you know, the new stuff, XML RPC, JSON RPC, and then you have your XMPP libraries. So what kind of tips and ideas can you throw out there for people who are developing a system in which they need to send out a request and they need to get a response? Do they queue it up locally? Do they throw in some type of a callback ID and then have an incoming queue that gets processed, which matches up the outgoing queue and then executes the, you know, call, that lets the process be done? You understand what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. And the short and the easy answer to your question is IQ packets, because info query packets do have an inherent expectation of a response and of generating a timeout in the event that the response is not forthcoming within a certain specified period of time. So it works just like your HTTP post response type of thing, where you can say, I'm going to have this much for a connection timeout and I'm going to have this much for a response timeout. And you will get one of two things, either a response or a timeout. And that's exactly how it works. And OpenFire is written beautifully to accommodate that. And that's what we did, because open loop communications guarantee data loss. And, you know, I'm sorry, but there's just way too many, I have too many years experience dealing with these kinds of things. And if you don't have a closed loop, you are going to lose data. And you'll never know it, because you don't get a timeout either. And this is, you know, you don't want to send data into a black hole, and particularly not where you have different parts of a, you know, if you are serving a request for a client and the servers have to go talk to among themselves and have a conversation for several seconds, which they do, there's like a dozen different steps that have to take place in order to do a payment. You have to be able to deal with all the failure cases. What happens if, you know, the DHT goes offline at an inopportune time? How does the system respond to that? Well, we had to answer those questions and actually had to code handling for all the timeouts and how do you recover and what do you queue it up? And then if you have a big queue and you reconnect, you don't want a message flood, so you have to portion them out every, you know, few a second or something.
Okay. Well,
I mean, all of that logic had to be put in there. So the short answer to a developer who wants to use XMPP as a request response system is just use the request response protocol that's part of the protocol, and that's the info query message.
Okay. Well, that's, I mean, I that sounds like a monumental project, you describing all the stuff that you had to do with all your distributed connected system. That's something else. But the let's try to go through a simple example here. Let's say that I am running a local client, and all I want to do is I want to check the balance on my account. And I'm not saying specifically voucher safe. I'm saying just a very simple system that says get balance with account ID. Just a basic check balance system for any type of a back-end system. And I run a script. Basically, what I'll do is I want to have a will initiate my XMPP connection to the XMPP server with my client and have that running. And then it would be processing, it would receive a from the local, the program itself that's running my client. I would say, I want to check the balance. So I would register that as a pending command. And then, I mean, you said there's the IQ, but that's just a description of a packet, right? I mean, I'm trying to like come up with a little timeline here of what I would do as a programmer, a good, what you would call a best, what do they call it?
Best practices.
Best practice.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a nice best practice so that I can send something out and I will have that in a message. Let's say I'll start a message, so I'll send out a message, and then that will go have a callback ID, and that will go into a pending queue on my client that's waiting. And the XMPP client is listening for incoming messages. And when it gets an incoming message, it looks at the callback ID and then matches it up with my local queue and then executes that or then, you know, returns that data back to the client. Is that basically about the best?
Yes. And all of that is actually done in we use something called it's another product from Jive Software. It's a library that deals with XMPP stuff. It's called SMAC. As in talking smack. And That's exactly what it does. It's actually using a linked blocking queue. It's a Java collections object. And it's actually using that to record all of the requests that it has outstanding. And an ID field isn't really a callback ID. It's a message ID. But that message ID is typically unique, and it's usually some kind of a serial number that increases monotonically. And that is matched up to the replies. The only part that you missed there is that if you are doing it with a timeout, and this is an option, you can send it without a timeout and just wait indefinitely if you like. But if you set it with a specific timeout, then it also sets a timer. And if the timer goes out, then it finds the thing in the list and it generates an error return, essentially, saying that you got a time. And then, of course, if the reply, the genuine reply, does come in late, it will just be thrown on the floor. It doesn't go to your callback because you've already cleared the request by getting the timeout.
Yeah, that's great because I can see, as a programmer, if I'm going to be doing this, I don't want to be sitting there thinking about XMPP. What I want to do is I want to have my XMPP class or my backend server class. I don't want to be thinking about what's going on with it and like wonder, oh, is it a timeout and this and this. I want to throw it out just like I do any other RPC or any other call where I have no idea whether it's being executed locally, whether it's remotely, whether it's RPC, synchronous, asynchronous, and then let it come back with the same type of response that I'll deal with no matter what way it went out. And that's a real nice way to do interfaces for libraries, especially. Well,
and that's exactly what SMAC and OpenFire, which implements its own sort of version of SMAC, both on the client and server side and the plugins, that's exactly what it does. You have an API that does that, where I just build my message, and I just derive classes that extended IQ, all right, and that have the packet extension XML and stuff built in them and know how to emit themselves as XML and parse themselves and so fill in the data fields and so on. And so you just create your object, you populate its values, and you just send it to the party you're trying to send it to, and the library does all the rest. And so, like you say, as a programmer, you don't have to deal with that because that's a solved problem. Yeah. And as I think it was Henry Spencer used to say, reinvented wheels are often square. And you don't want to be running on square wheels. So if this is a solved problem, and that's one of the great things about programming in Java, is that there's a jar file that will do almost anything that you want to do. And there's probably even an open source one that you can actually go read the source to find out how it works. And I will say about the people at Jive, I've never really had to deal with them. And that's a good thing. Because in all the years of using their OpenFire server and using their SMAC library and so on, I have never had to go and actually fix a problem in their code. And I think that's pretty darn impressive. Because if you look at the complexity of the things that we're actually trying to do here, and we're making these OpenFire servers with their plugins jump through hoops that are probably more complex than the server, and we've never actually had to modify the harness that they're running in order to get the plugin to work properly, and that's pretty cool, and that's over about six releases that they've had, and I've never seen one crash either. They run for hundreds of days. Run like a top. They do all the memory management, the reclamation, the garbage collection. We do have to run with the incremental garbage collector on just so that you don't, suddenly get into a memory crunch and the system goes away for a few seconds while it frantically garbage collects. You don't want that. So that's why we turn on the incremental garbage collection operation. So it sort of spends a tenth of a second every, minute or something, doing its garbage collection on an ongoing basis. But all that stuff, it has to be, had to be looked at, and it's extremely robust. And as a programmer, I'm impressed when somebody's API works the way they documented it, and it actually does what they said it does, and it does it reliably, and it does it predictably. As I got into working with this, I said, hey, this is great. We have this library and this API that's all published source. Now, there have been some times when I have had to go in and look at how they coded something in order to figure out how it works or why it wasn't working the way I thought. But I've never actually had to go fix their stuff.
Yeah.
And I hope I never do. But it, you know, if you do, you can build it with your version. You know, you can build a customized one easily enough. It's not hard to do. You just drop it in place and let Ant do the rest. You know, so it's not like it would be hard or be a showstopper if we had to change their code. But yeah. So far, we haven't had to do that.
Oh, that's great. That's a nice little tip there. Little question on there on the open fire thing with the modules. Do they support modules written in other languages?
No. Well, actually, you probably could if you supported it in your own plugin. You could run native libraries or something of that sort. I'm not really sure why you would do that, because at the server level, I mean, OpenFire and Java are well supported on just about any version of Linux or Windows servers or anything else that you would probably be running. And I don't see why you would need to write native language code to do any of this. I mean, it's just parsing XML and writing the sockets. I mean, anybody's implementation of the Java virtual machine on just about any device ought to be able to handle that.
Yeah, no, the reason would be is because there's, I mean, like a lot of the modular stuff out there, you may have people who don't do anything in Java, but are masters in other languages that just want to, like,
Oh, right.
That gets called when it comes in.
What I would suggest is that, and what I think will probably happen, is that, you know, we've written a couple of clients. As I think I said in the last show, there's a Java web app client that you can run from inside a browser and then install in your box and just, you know, run it from the icon on your desktop after that. And then there is a Spark client for a particular Jabber client. But a lot of people may have a preferred Jabber client that they don't want to use Spark. So that's probably not for everybody. And then there is a command line client that isn't fully baked yet, but it's basically a voucher shell where it's sort of like FTP or something, you know, where you would connect up to the OFS gateway and you type commands at it, like log in to a particular voucher safe and here's my PIN and so on. It prompts you for stuff and it logs you in. And then you say LS vouchers and LS tokens and, you know, make payment to some, you know, and so that's there, and that kind of a client opens up the possibility that somebody could skin it, you know, in much the same way that Enigmail works as a plugin inside of Thunderbird that connects a command line service called GPG to doing emails, and then lets you have your GUI interface for emails, and I think that is one of the paths that will be used in the future, because. Of course, you don't have to do it that way. I mean, one could just simply start at the, you know, if somebody wrote a client for VoucherSafe that simply followed the protocol, and you know, you can download off the VoucherSafe.org site, you can download the, there's a file called iqextensions.zip, and if you did that, you would get all of the extensions to the info query packets, to all the XML specifications of all the messages that deal with, you know, the ones you'd be really concerned with would be between the client, the voucher VSC, the voucher safe client, and other partners. But those are the ones you all have to implement. You don't have to implement the server-to-server ones, obviously. But if you implemented all of that and did it correctly, our servers wouldn't be able to tell the difference between one client, a client we wrote, and a client somebody else wrote. As long as they're sending well-formed XML and everything they're sending, it makes sense and is in the right namespaces and so on, it's going to be processed. So, I think between a combination of somebody putting a graphical skin on top of a command line interface, on top of a CLI, and somebody putting writing their own client from scratch. I mean, if you were writing like an iPhone app or something, and this is something we've talked about doing, I think you'd probably want to start from scratch, and just, you know, write in Objective-C or whatever or there's various, you know, kinds of development packages that you can get for that. And I haven't really looked at them in any detail yet to see whether they have all the crypto that we'd need and all the XMPP and XML parsing and XML pull parser and all that other kind of stuff that you need underlying to do that. But assuming you had all the necessary tools, assuming you had all the necessary library functionality, you can write your own client. And at that point, I would say you could use the Java code that I've written as a jumping off point. You say, how do we handle this? What do we have to watch out for? You know, how can we do this? And look at it at the sort of messaging level, how it actually talks to the network, and do that.
Yeah, great. great. Well, that's interesting, too. Oh, man. Well, we're closing up here.
I think we have to.
we covered a lot of good, really good ground. This is great information, and I know this a lot of it is very pertinent to people are working on right now and are interested in hearing about. So, Justin, thank you very much for coming on today, and I hope to have you on again in the future to talk about other aspects of the system.
Well, I hope that you'll be able to have me on again maybe in a couple of weeks when we've actually got a live system running that people can actually use, and maybe we can approach it more from a user perspective in terms of, you know, how do I get up and running on using this this system.
Great, you're talking real assets at that time.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, if you consider dollars and euros real assets, I know there are probably listeners out there who would take issue with that if I claimed that those were real assets. But shall we say real currency that people use in the real world?
Yeah. No, it sounds fantastic. That's exciting news also. Great way to end up the show. Super.
Okay. Thanks, well, as always, thanks a lot, Hero, and look forward to talking to you again.
Yep. Thank you again also. Take care, Justin. Bye.
All righty. Bye-bye.
All right. Wow. That was a fascinating show. If you're a cypherpunk, I'm sure you're going to find it a little fascinating. And we're going to close out here with more 99 Mix by Crystal Method. We'll see everyone tomorrow.
Dodge this.
This is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. AgoristRadio.com is sponsored by MetroPipe.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
Broadcasting from deep within the Second Realm, you are listening to AgoristRadio.com.